From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Fire in the Gaza Strip. As gunfights break out in Gaza and the West Bank, fears of a civil war between Hamas and Fatah are escalating. We'll go to Gaza to get the latest, then a look at the civilian death toll in Iraq.
Can the press pretend they've done even a credible job of reporting in Iraq if they have consistently downplayed the number of deaths by a factor of 10?
Les Roberts, one of the authors of the recent study that found about 650,000 civilians have died in Iraq since the invasion. He was speaking at a congressional briefing held by Ohio lawmaker Dennis Kucinich one day after he announced his bid for the presidency. We'll play excerpts. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm broadcasting from Midtown Manhattan. I'm Amy Goodman. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Bush administration is leaning towards sending up to 20,000 more troops to Iraq. Aides say no final decisions have been made, but that the White House has been receptive to calls to increase the current contingent of 140,000. A poll this week showed just 12% of Americans support a troop increase in Iraq. Word of the apparent plan comes as the Army's top general has warned his force will break without an influx of thousands active duty troops and reserves. Testifying on Capitol Hill Thursday, General Peter Schoomaker said current demands would require an increase of at least 7,000 troops per year. In the occupied territories, fears of a Palestinian civil war are growing as violence continues to engulf Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas. On Thursday, a convoy carrying Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh was attacked after crossing into the Gaza Strip. One of Haniyeh's bodyguards was killed, while Haniyeh's son was wounded with light injuries. Palestinian border guards linked to Fatah had initially obeyed orders from Israel to block Haniyeh's entrance. The guards also refused to let Haniyeh bring $35 million in cash he'd collected on a foreign trip to help ease the economic crisis in Gaza. Earlier Thursday, Linda Belusha, the mother of three young children murdered on their way to school Monday, appealed for national unity.
I lost my three children, but I would like to keep the children that I have. This is why I say, speak up, enough injustice, let us forget what faction we belong to. Let us all be one people and to care for our children. Our blood is not cheap for us, not cheap for our families, nor our children. Save your blood, enough of the disregard of lives, enough of the disregard of the people living here as if they don't exist, as if all that exists is the factions and the people are at the bottom of the chain.
More from Gaza after headlines. Meanwhile, in Israel, the Supreme Court has upheld the military's practice of targeted killings in the occupied territories. On Thursday, the court rejected a petition from Palestinian and Israeli human rights groups that targeted killings violate international law. According to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, the more than 200 targeted killings have killed 129 civilian bystanders. In Afghanistan, hundreds of people rallied in the southeastern province of Khost Thursday against a U.S.-led raid that killed at least four civilians, including a teenage girl. This is Abdul Sobhain, a tribal leader in the village of Dornami.
We gathered here to express our anger at the brutal killing of four men and one young woman in a family the day before yesterday by foreigner soldiers. The foreign soldiers entered the house of a family from the Mandozai tribe and killed innocent people. We want to know why these innocent people have been killed.
At the United Nations, the veteran South Korean diplomat Ban Ki-moon was sworn in Thursday as the UN's 8th Secretary General.
By strengthening the three pillars of the United Nations, security, development, and human rights, we can build a more peaceful, more prosperous, and more just world for our succeeding generations. As we pursue our collective endeavor to reach that goal, my first priority will be to restore trust. I will seek to act as a harmonizer and bridge builder.
In one of his last addresses, outgoing Secretary General Kofi Annan praised his successor.
I depart convinced that today's United Nations does more than ever before. It does it better than ever before. Yet, our work is far from complete. Indeed, it will never be. It falls to my successor to carry forward the UN's valuable mission. From the contacts I've had with him, I already know that you have chosen well. Our organization will be in safe hands.
Kofi Annan steps down at the end of the month. In other UN news, outgoing U.S. Ambassador John Bolton joined a group of international lawyers and former diplomats Thursday to announce plans to charge Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad with inciting genocide against Israel. Ahmadinejad has called for Israel's elimination, and this week said Israel would soon be wiped out.
In the case of Ahmadinejad, not only is what he says outrageous and unacceptable, but what he's doing about it and what his government is doing about it demonstrates that this is not merely a series of statements about his intentions. His government is seeking to acquire the capabilities to do exactly what he's talking about.
The Bush administration has issued another public rejection of the Iraq study group's call to open talks with Syria and Iran. In an interview with The Washington Post Thursday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the cost of reaching a deal with Iran and Syria would be too high. The White House also denounced Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida for meeting this week with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But more senators are on their way to Damascus. Democratic Senators Christopher Dodd and John Kerry of Massachusetts and Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania have all announced plans to visit Syria within the next month. In Britain, the family of Jean-Charles de Manessas have lost their appeal of a decision not to charge any of the police officers involved in his shooting death. De Manessas was the innocent Brazilian man shot in the London subway last year after police mistook him to be a possible terrorist. Back in the United States, Democratic Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota is said to be in stable yet critical condition following emergency operation to stop bleeding in his brain. Johnson's illness could hand Senate control back to Republicans. If Johnston is forced to give up his seat, South Dakota Governor Republican Mike Rounds would choose his replacement. If Rounds were to choose a Republican, that would mean a 50-50 tie in the Senate. That would hand control back to Republicans because Vice President Dick Cheney would hold the tie-breaking vote. In Florida, opponents of the death penalty have filed a petition to halt lethal injection after an execution of a death row prisoner took more than half an hour. The prisoner, Angel Diaz, was killed Wednesday by a three-drug cocktail used in Florida and other death penalty states. Witnesses reported Diaz appeared to suffer and had to have the drugs administered twice. Petitioners are asking the state Supreme Court to halt lethal injection and order an autopsy on Diaz's body. Diaz is a native of Puerto Rico. He was executed over the objections of Puerto Rican officials, including Governor Acevedo Avila and Senate President Kenneth McClintock. In Miami, a jailed man accused of leading the so-called Miami 7 has spoken out for the first time since his arrest last June. The man, Narcel Batiste, is one of the seven charged with conspiring to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago and FBI buildings in five cities. The case has drawn scrutiny because it appears to rest entirely on Batiste's conversations with an FBI informant posing as a representative of Al-Qaeda. The FBI later described the alleged plot as aspirational rather than operational. In an open letter, Batiste said his group never had terrorist intentions and only told the informant what he thought the informant wanted to hear so he could solicit money for his religious group. In New Jersey, state lawmakers legalized same-sex civil unions Thursday, but said those civil unions cannot be called marriage. The measure follows October's ruling by New Jersey's Supreme Court. The state must grant gay couples the same legal rights as married heterosexuals. In North Carolina, the woman at the center of the Duke lacrosse rape case is pregnant and due to give birth roughly 9 months after the party where she says she was assaulted and raped. The woman, an African-American, was hired as a dancer for a lacrosse team party held in a house rented from Duke University. There, she says, she was beaten, raped, and choked by three white lacrosse team members who also called her racial epithets. All three players have proclaimed their innocence. And finally, a federal appeals court has upheld the rejection of a case brought by descendants of slaves seeking reparations from several large American corporations. The court ruled slave descendants have no grounds to sue over injustices suffered by their ancestors and that the statute of limitations expired more than a century ago. But in a decision held by reparations advocates, the court ruled companies that try to conceal their past links to slavery can be charged with fraud. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fears of a civil war between Palestinian factions inside Gaza and the West Bank are escalating. Gunfights broke out today between Hamas and Fatah in Gaza City and Ramallah. This comes one day after Hamas accused Fatah gunmen of attempting to assassinate Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh. Haniyeh's convoy was attacked shortly after it had crossed into Gaza from Egypt after a standoff at the border. Video footage shot at the border shows Haniyeh's convoy coming under fire. One of Haniyeh's bodyguards died after being shot in the head. Haniyeh's son was injured in the shooting. Hamas officials have accused key Fatah legislator Mahmoud Dahlan of orchestrating the attack. The fighting on Thursday began when Israel shut down the border crossing in order to prevent Haniyeh from re-entering Gaza after a fundraising tour. He was holding tens of millions of dollars in donations collected to help ease the economic crisis in Gaza. After a seven-hour standoff, border control guards linked to Fatah allowed Haniyeh to enter Gaza, but without the money. Tensions have been high all week between the rival Palestinian factions. On Monday, three young boys were murdered on their way to school in Gaza. They were the sons of a senior intelligence official linked to President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement. On Sunday, gunmen believed to be linked to Fatah attacked the convoy of Interior Minister of the Hamas government. Palestinian journalist Leila Al-Haddad joins us now on the phone from Gaza. She runs the blog titled Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. We're also joined from Jerusalem by Muin Rabbani, the senior Middle East analyst with the International Crisis Group and a contributing editor to the Middle East Report. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Leila Al-Haddad, let's begin with you. Describe what it's like on the ground right now.
Well, the tension in Gaza is really palpable in the air, Amy. I mean, you can feel it outside and maybe cut it with a knife, and stores are generally keeping closed and people keeping inside their homes. But I would still refer to the situation and the incidents as being relatively isolated in terms of the clashes, at least in Gaza, to the border and maybe one or two locations in Gaza City that have all but died down. So things, are threatening certainly to spill over at any moment, but for right now, very calm, and there's a large demonstration of a few tens of thousands of Hamas supporters, men and women right now, celebrating Hamas's 19th anniversary of its creation. And Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh just made an appearance, and he's due to give a talk in just a few minutes, I think.
And where is that?
That's in the Yarmouk Stadium in central Gaza City.
And the response to the attack on him at the border?
Well, I was just talking to people, just sort of ordinary people on the street, and many people in general just seem disgusted with the situation as a whole, not specifically that, but the incidents of the past week in general, beginning with the attack on the children and then the assassination of a Hamas judge in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, Bassam al-Farra, who was killed a few days ago, the second judge to be killed in 1 week in Gaza. And so people are generally fed up, and they're really fearing for their lives, and they don't know who to trust anymore and who's in control. And many just saying they really want to see progress made. They're still holding out hope that a unity government can be formed.
Muin Rabbani, your evaluation of what is going on right now on the attack on the prime minister, the killing of the three young brothers?
Well, I would agree with Leila that the situation is explosive, but it would be very premature to speak of the beginning of a Palestinian civil war or anything on that scale. I think what we're seeing now also has to be seen in the context of two developments. The first is the decision by the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, to terminate or at least suspend coalition talks with Hamas about 10 or 14 days ago. And the second is that Abbas will be giving a major address at noon tomorrow, in which he's expected to respond to the recommendation of the PLO Executive Committee that he set a schedule for early elections. It's unclear whether he will announce a date for early elections. Most people think he won't, but simply by raising the idea less than a year after Hamas achieved power in free and fair elections is seen by the Islamists as an attempt, as they put it, to launch a coup against their democratic victory. And that's certainly increasing tensions very much between these two movements.
And Hamas accusing Fatah of the attack, particularly naming the legislator Dahlan?
Well, that's a significant escalation. I mean, he's never been well-liked by Hamas. But until today, apart from a few personal denunciations of Mahmoud Abbas by Khaled Mashal, the leader of the Hamas Politburo in Damascus, they have not specifically singled out a Fatah politician or warlord as being responsible for specific incidents. Now, by doing so, I think they've significantly upped the ante.
Leila Eldad, the Israeli deputy defense minister, Ephraim Sneh, told Israel's army radio government officials made the right decision in not allowing Haniyeh to bring the, I think it was about $35 million, back into the occupied territories. Your response?
Well, I mean, it's not the first time that obviously Israel has tried to block the entry of Hamas officials carrying aid in cash to Gaza, which, of course, they've been forced to do because of the total ban on and the economic blockade on Gaza, and including bank wires and so forth. And so, I mean, many people obviously see the action as absolutely criminal. Others say the undeclared cash needs to go to a reliable source, and so I think they've deposited it in the Arab bank. But in general, it's just again, reinforcing the view, especially in Gaza amongst ordinary Palestinians, that the Israelis have continued to and always have continued to control the Rafah crossing, which is, of course, the only inlet and outlet, the only passage for Palestinians in and out of Gaza.
Leila, talk about that crossing. How long did you spend there with your son trying to get into Gaza?
Yeah, the line's going in and out. I can barely hear you, but I spent nearly a month in Egypt waiting for the crossing to open, and 2.5 weeks of those of that month near the Egyptian side of the Rafah crossing, waiting for it to open about 50 kilometers away in the town of Al Arish. And on two particular days, we heard the crossing might open. It was actually one of the days was the day that Palestinian Foreign Minister Mahmoud Zahar was going into Gaza, also carrying about $20 million in cash. And similarly, the Israelis had tried to block his entry. And so we had gone to the border hearing that of its imminent opening. The border has only been open for about 22, 23 days since late June, actually a day or two prior to the capture, the Palestinian capture of an Israeli soldier. And it's been effectively closed since, opening sporadically, like I said, for a few days only. And again, this is the only way people can get in and out of Gaza. And so on those 2 days, we went, and I went with about 5,000 or so others, including the sick, people who had gone to get treatment that's not available in Gaza, in Egypt, on their way back to Gaza, and students and family members wanting to reunite, and just ordinary people really wanting to go about their lives. And just being able to do that has become a chore, of course. The basic routine matters has become a task.
Muin Rabban. Rabbani, I wanted to ask you very quickly the effect of this international aid freeze on stoking the tensions between Hamas and Fatah.
Well, I think there's a very clear connection between the two. I mean, the fundamental issue here is that Hamas is being prevented from the right to govern in accordance with its democratic political mandate. At the same time, I think the siege and so on has done much to raise the tensions between the two movements, particularly if one takes into consideration the view of Hamas that Fatah, or at least key elements in Fatah, are actively collaborating with the quartet to impose a siege, and the perspective of Fatah that Hamas is responsible for the suffering of the Palestinian people by not capitulating to the quartet.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Muin Rabbani, senior Middle East analyst with the International Crisis Group, contributing editor at the Middle East Report. Also on the line with us from Gaza, Leila Haddad, the Palestinian journalist and mother who lives in Gaza, writes for AlJazeera.net and other publications, and keeps her own blog, Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. By Nassal Gwan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go to Mexico and our continuing coverage of the popular uprising in Oaxaca, on Sunday, thousands of people marched to demand the resignation of the state governor, Ulises Ruiz, and the withdrawal of federal police. Ruiz has been accused of rigging his election win and overseeing widespread human rights abuses. He sent a massive police force to crack down on the protests led by the Popular Assembly of the Oaxacan Peoples, or APO. Independent journalist John Gibler is on the ground in Oaxaca. He filed this report.
On Sunday, the Oaxaca People's Popular Assembly, or APO, took to the streets for the first time since federal police lifted the last protest camp in Oaxaca, beating and imprisoning over 140 protesters and opening the way for state police to carry out a witch hunt for APO organizers. In the following days, state police pulled people off the streets and from their homes, raising the number of detentions to 200. Felipe Calderon took office on December 1, amidst chaotic protests inside Congress, stepping into the presidency with the weakest mandate in Mexican history. Calderon's campaign promise was to maintain order with an iron fist, but his first acts in office seemed more like preparations for war.
He cuts the education budget, he cuts from health care, he cuts from the arts, and he raises the army's budget. So where are we going?
On Calderon's third day in office, federal police, acting on arrest warrants issued by a Oaxaca state judge, captured the APO delegation scheduled to reopen talks with the federal government the next day. State authorities have issued similar warrants for hundreds of APO protesters, driving many into hiding and fueling speculation that the federal crackdown and ongoing detentions had finally defeated the movement. With the APO's presence virtually erased from Oaxaca City, Sunday's march was a crucial test of the movement's ability to retake the streets.
APO has decided to regenerate its internal organization, to break the fear and terror imposed by the state and federal governments, to once again begin to take the streets. The fact that people are able to break the fear and go into the streets is a complete triumph for us.
And people did go into the streets. Some 15,000 marched for miles from the outskirts of Oaxaca City to within three blocks of the federal police barricades around the town plaza. Protesters carried pictures of imprisoned and missing friends and family members. Most of the prisoners taken during the federal police raid were transferred to a medium security prison in Nayarit, four states away and out of reach for most Oaxaca families. Jessica Sanchez with the Mexican Human Rights Defense League reported that prisoners were held incomunicado for days to prevent human rights workers from detecting signs of torture. But the prisoners, who were denied medical attention in jail, had been beaten too badly for the signs to go away.
Most of the people have had their heads broken. They have stitches and broken cheekbones and blood still in their eyes. In one case, a woman had her right leg completely destroyed by the beating they gave her.
Along the length of the march, local residents came out to support the protest. The APO reiterated its principal demand, the governor's removal from office, and also called for the withdrawal of the federal police from Oaxaca City, the demilitarization of the countryside, and the immediate release of all political prisoners. Organizers exercised extreme caution to avoid infiltration by agitators that could lead to acts of violence, and successfully steered the protest away from police barricades. The march ended peacefully with protesters filling the Plaza de la Danza. APO organizers remained defiant in the wake of the most severe crackdown in the six-month conflict. They claim that they have not been defeated and vowed to continue their struggle until all their demands are met.
For us, it was not a defeat because the popular assembly was inspired by the indigenous communal assemblies. If we have resisted for more than 514 years and our institutions have resisted, our popular assembly will continue resisting. It wasn't a defeat. On the contrary, this gives us more strength to continue. No,
al contrario, esto nos da más fuerzas para seguir adelante.
In Oaxaca City, for Democracy Now!, this is John Gibler with Big Noise Films.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Midtown Manhattan. After the show at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I'll go across the street and join C-SPAN. Brian Lamb has come to New York for Washington Journal. I'll be joining Brian Lamb and my brother and co-author David Goodman to talk about our book, Static, and it's a call-in show, so I hope you will join us. That's on C-SPAN. Well, earlier this week, Ohio Democratic Congress member Dennis Kucinich announced he's running for president again. He's accused the leadership of the Democratic Party of not pushing hard enough to end the Iraq War. A day before he announced his presidential bid, Kucinich held a congressional briefing on a topic seldom publicly discussed on Capitol Hill, the Iraq civilian death toll. To speak, Kucinich invited the authors of the recent study that found about 650,000 Iraq civilians have died in Iraq since the war began. The study was published in October in the prestigious British medical journal Lancet. The Middle East scholar and University of Michigan professor Juan Cole was invited to speak. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich opened the hearing.
We are rapidly approaching the grave number of 3,000 dead U.S. service members. But as painful as that is, and it's very painful, the estimated 650,000 deaths attributed to hostilities in Iraq is an overwhelming number to comprehend. While it is natural and appropriate for Americans to first focus upon the deaths of American service members in Iraq, it's astounding to consider that for every service member killed, 200 Iraqi civilians have been killed. According to the United Nations, the population of Iraq was 25 million in 2003. And we have now learned that since then, an estimated 650,000 have perished to violence. Now, if such a rate of violence were to be inflicted against the U.S., we would have lost about 7.8 million Americans. Such level of violence is unimaginable. But this is the level of violence that the civilians in Iraq are subjected to. Consider the massive psychological impact the 9/11 attacks and resulting deaths have had on our nation. Imagine the impact we'd feel as a nation if over a period of 3 years, 7.8 million of our citizens died in ongoing, uncontrollable violence. Consider the political impact of violence at that scale. Are we closer to a stable transition in Iraq, or are we closer to collapse? How would we react if this was happening here? With the help of Congressman Paul, I've assembled a panel of experts to help us grasp the civilian situation in Iraq and its impact on Iraq society. I hope to explore many vexing questions by leading a discussion with the experts who are here with us today. What confidence do we have in the U.S. administration responses on the number of Iraqi fatalities? Who is getting killed? By whom and why? What does this violence do to the prospects of peace in Iraq? What are the short-term and long-term implications of this massive number of deaths to Iraqi civil society? Will the millions of Iraqi children who have lost a parent ever forgive our country for igniting this violence? How do we make peace with the generations of Iraqis severely harmed by this unnecessary war of choice? We have to ask these questions. We have to understand what the Iraqi citizenry thinks and feels to understand why this violence has escalated far beyond our control. Now, I have no doubt that the best course of action for our nation is to extract ourselves from Iraq as fast as possible while enabling the United Nations to establish a peacekeeping force. Such action would remove our troops from harm's way, remove the largest impetus for the violence, and begin the healing process, which will take decades to complete. Our president does not seem to understand the necessity to get out of Iraq. Thus, it is imperative that Congress do the one thing the Constitution of the United States provides for. Congress must cut off future war funds and demand that the president use the current funds in the pipeline from the October 1st $70 billion appropriation to bring the troops home.
Presidential hopeful Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. Dr. Les Roberts of Johns Hopkins University, one of the co-authors of the Lancet study on Iraqi civilian casualties, also spoke at the briefing.
What if what Gil Burnham just described is correct? That is, what if 600,000 Iraqis have died because of this preemptive venture? Would Congress have approved this had they known in advance? Can the press pretend they've done even a credible job of reporting in Iraq if they have consistently downplayed the number of deaths by a factor of 10? Can we in academia and in those think tanks around Washington pretend that we add value to discourse in society if something almost identical in magnitude to the Rwandan genocide could more or less go unnoticed by our society? According to the United Nations, the Iraqi government surveillance network reported exactly zero violent deaths from Anbar province in the month of July, in spite of all the contradictory evidence we saw if we watched CNN. The most widely cited sources, IBC, the United Nations, Brookings, report about 80% of all violent deaths coming from Baghdad. And as Dr. Burnham mentioned, Baghdad actually is only about as violent as the nation on average. So here it is, one-fifth of the country reporting four-fifths of all violent deaths, and we know their rate of violent death isn't any higher than the rest. Something is wrong with those sources. Similar incompleteness has been noted by the coalition surveillance activities. The Baker-Hamilton report of last week on page 95 said, and I quote, "For example, on one day in July of 2006, there were 93 attacks or significant acts of violence reported. Yet a careful review of the reports for that single day brought to light 1,100 violent acts. We feel our estimate is by far the best available in spite of considerable imprecision. We also feel that in terms of understanding the situation in Iraq. In terms of moving forward, it's important to know, has 1 in 7 houses in Iraq lost a loved one, or 1 in 100, as Iraqi body count would suggest? Now, we're the society that eradicated smallpox from the face of the earth primarily by setting up surveillance networks, including during really violent conflicts in East Pakistan and Somalia and Biafra. We're the society that produced most of the medical developments that are taught in medical schools around the world. We gave the world the internet as a nation of information excellence. It is, I think, beneath our dignity, and I hope not in keeping with the compassion of the American people, to have U.S. government officials consistently downplaying the number of dead in Iraq by a factor of 10 and 15.
Dr. Les Roberts of Johns Hopkins University, one of the co-authors of the study. University of Michigan professor and Middle East scholar Juan Cole criticized the media's coverage of the Iraqi civilian casualties.
I've been dismayed as someone who's followed these events on a daily basis from the Arabic and Persian press, from Western wire services, from talking to Iraqis on the ground. I've been dismayed for the past 3.5 years at the way in which the seriousness of this problem was downplayed by politicians in Washington and by the U.S. Media, both the print and the television and radio press. This was a situation that was clearly out of control and very dangerous already in the summer of and fall of 2003, at a time when we were being told by Washington that there was no guerrilla war in Iraq. And it is still being disputed in Washington in the face of these enormous numbers that there is no civil war in Iraq. I can't tell you exactly why the state of constant denial should be with us. I am glad to see that NBC News is now using the word civil war and dismayed to see that it's controversial at this point. I don't know what else you would call a conflict producing these kinds of casualties, where you have militias attacking one another every day. And the sheer horror of this war is something that we miss. When it's reported in the news that 50 bodies were found in Baghdad, do you realize that there's actually a corpse patrol in the Iraqi police? That this is one of the duties, if you're a policeman, that you get up in the morning and you go around looking for the bodies that are showing up in the streets that day. And the UN reports that these bodies show signs of drilling, of chemical exposure, of torture of various sorts. And then typically they have a bullet behind the ear, mafia style. And 50, 60 of them every day are showing up in Baghdad. And then more are showing up in places like Baquba and elsewhere. And even in Mosul now, you begin to see some of these statistics emerging. And this is the tip of the iceberg. It was thrown up against the Lancet report that, well, it implies that there are 500 deaths around the country a day from political and criminal violence. How could that be? Well, I mean, the news reports that we're getting, if you consider them to be the tip of the iceberg, if you just think about, well, what are the forces that are producing these results on a daily basis, it's obvious that only a small number of the deaths that actually occur are being reported in the wire services. I see deaths reported in the Arabic press all the time that never surface in the English language wire services. So I agree with Professor Roberts that, you know, a sense of contrition, a recognition of the reality here of what the actions of the United States have done to an entire country, to a civilization, is in order, and we cannot debate what should be done in Iraq unless we have a clear-eyed vision of what has been done in Iraq.
University of Michigan Professor Juan Cole. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back to the hearing in a minute.
وبصدري من الأسى كربلا فجراح الحسين بعد جراحي وبصدري من الأسى كربلا مرحبا يا عراق كيف العباء وكيف المها وكيف الطباء مرحبا يا عراق هل نسبني بعد طول السنين سمرا أكل الحب من حشاشة قلبي والبقايا تقاسمت النساء كان عندي هنا أميرة حب ثم ضاعت أميرة الحسناء كان عندي هنا أميرة حب ثم ضاعت أميرة الحسناء وأنا الحزن من زمان صديقي وقليل في عصرنا الأصدقاء
Haba Iraq, Shep Abed, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the briefing held by Ohio Congressmember and presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich, he asked University of Michigan professor Juan Cole if he believes the results of the Lancet study are further evidence of a civil war in Iraq.
There isn't any doubt that there's a civil war in Iraq. My colleague at the University of Michigan, David Singer, ran a project on the statistics and correlates of war and developed the most widely used measurement of what a civil war is. And his team specified that if you have multiple, at least two parties contending for power, and in Iraq you have the Sunni Arab guerrilla movement and you have the Shiite militias, and if they produce at least 1,000 casualties of war a year. And if in battles between the insurgents and the central government, the insurgents acquit themselves relatively well, and this happens in Iraq, then you have a civil war. So Iraq is a civil war magnified many times over by these criteria. Many much smaller conflicts have been called civil war by social scientists. In Iraq, I think we have something that goes beyond civil war. This is one of the great civil conflicts of the past few years. I mean, one really has to go to Cambodia and Afghanistan to find similar sorts of proportional numbers of deaths.
Let's go to a moment with your background in history in the region. You've seen the high mortality rates that Dr. Burnham and Roberts talk about with respect to young men. Let's talk for a moment about the implications of the high mortality rate for young men.
Well, the high mortality rate for young men is probably being produced by their having joined these guerrilla groups and militia movements. And they have joined these movements for a number of reasons. First of all, there's very high rates of unemployment in Iraq. It's difficult to know exactly what the figure is. Anything from 30 to 60% is reported. But certainly there are very large numbers of families that simply have no real source of income. These militias get funding in various ways, through petroleum smuggling, through antiquity smuggling, through monies coming in from neighboring countries, from donors. And so getting a job as a militiaman for a young man is actually a source of income. And many young men who might not otherwise prefer this way of life are forced into it by unemployment and poverty.
Well, if you have so many young males lost in a society, how does the loss of young males affect Iraqi society in terms of long-term impact?
Well, obviously, this is the cohort that will be the backbone of the society in the future. Ordinarily, these are the young people that would go on to lead productive lives, to be workers, to be professionals, and their lives are being lost in Iraq, which is a relatively traditional society. It is a patriarchal society. Women haven't traditionally been in the workforce very much, so a lot of these young men would have been the breadwinners for their family, as there's not a strong social security mechanism from the government. So as the head of the household ages, retires, it would be his sons who would be supporting the family. So many families are losing those precise younger men who would bring in an income. So the implications for throwing large numbers of Iraqis into poverty are very high. Of course, many of the young men who are being killed are already married, so it's producing widows with children without means of support. Prostitution and various forms of coercion for women have increased as a result. Very large numbers of women have been forced to flee to Jordan or Syria, where they end up working as dancing girls or as prostitutes. So the situation is really quite horrible for those families that are losing their breadwinners.
Professor Cole said it's plausible 650,000 Iraqi civilians have died violently in Iraq since the war began.
Let me just give you some case studies to show what I'm talking about, because it's often the report has been criticized with regard to statistics, to reported deaths that appear in the press. I want to emphasize to you that the press just isn't reporting very many of the actual deaths in Iraq. For instance, security clearly collapsed in the southern Shiite city of Basra, population 1.3 million in spring of 2006. Iraqi officials maintained in April that for the previous month, one Iraqi had been assassinated each hour. This is in the city of Basra, one city. These some 750 deaths had gone completely unreported in both the Iraqi and the Western press. If you go back and do a Lexis search for Basra in March and April of 2006, you don't see any deaths reported at all there. It is not clear that the al-Maliki government's deployment to Basra of the 10th Army Division this past summer made much of a difference in the violence, which is committed by militias and tribal mafias fighting turf wars over petroleum smuggling and other sources of wealth. It is entirely possible that the 750 a month are still dying in Basra, but that these deaths are going unreported. Again, if you just look at the daily wire service reports coming out of Iraq, these kinds of deaths for Basra are not being mentioned. Families are often afraid to draw attention to themselves by publicly reporting deaths and guerrilla violence, and sometimes they're even afraid to retrieve the body of a loved one from the morgue, lest morgue officials report them to the guerrillas for a bribe. The estimate given by the Iraqi Health Ministry on November 9, 2006, of 150,000 Iraqis killed since the war began according to what the health minister said, was with regard to deaths caused by Sunni Arab insurgents. He was very specific in the cause of the death that he was announcing. So it wasn't a global estimate of 150,000. As I understood it, it was from that particular source. So we add in the number of deaths from criminal activity, and there's quite a lot in Iraq, from Shiite militias, which the Ministry of Health didn't refer to, and from U.S. military action. Actually, the health ministry is probably pretty close to the Lancet estimate if you extrapolate it out. Let's just consider the humanitarian disaster in a place like Diyala province, northeast of Baghdad. This is a mixed region near to Iran with a population of 1.3 million. It has a Sunni Arab preponderance, but it has Shiites and Kurds. In the provincial elections of January 2005, the Sunnis boycotted the polls. As a result, the provincial council consists of 20 Shiites, 14 Sunnis, and 7 Kurds. The Shiites have the predominance on the council, and they therefore have brought in their guys in the police, in the army, and so forth. So the governor and the police chief of Baquba, the capital of the province, are Shiites. The Shiite-dominated local police have been supported in recent weeks by the 5th Army Division, which is Shiite and commanded by a Shiite officer. Sunni Arabs have organized local militias in their districts to keep the police and army out. This is being coded as lawlessness by the U.S. press and military, but it is actually a rejection of dominance by the new elected Shiite political elite. And the U.S. military is careful to say that it is not supporting one side or another in the sectarian violence in Diyala. It says we're just supporting the elected government. Well, as it happens, the elected government is mainly Shiite. So the U.S. military actually is supporting one side. The reports coming out from Baquba and Diyala generally through November show a steady drumbeat of violence. On Sunday, November 5th, in response to the announcement of the death sentence for Saddam Hussein, hundreds or perhaps thousands of unarmed Sunni Arab protesters gathered in Baquba carrying posters of Saddam. They also raised banners criticizing the al-Maliki government. It's often alleged by the Shiites that Baquba is a hotbed for al-Qaeda. But here we have the Sunni Arabs showing support for the secular Saddam. Local police fired into the crowd, allegedly killing 20 and wounding 23. These are largely Shiite police firing on Sunni Arab protesters. The Times of Baghdad al-Zaman branded the repression a massacre. And most days through November, you find reports like that. On November 13th, CBS News reported that 50 bodies were found, discarded like trash in Baquba. On the same day, 40 bodies that had accumulated in the morgue and not been claimed were buried. On November 15th, AP reported that Iraqi police, backed by U.S. forces, discovered the bodies of 10 kidnapped victims, bound, blindfolded, with gunshot wounds in a house in Baquba. And then major violence broke out in mid-November. On Saturday, November 18th, Sunni Arab guerrillas in Baquba attacked a police checkpoint, killing 2 policemen and wounding 2 others, and then opened fire on residents. These are Shiite residents, after pulling them from their homes or automobiles. They shot at Shiite seasonal workers returning to Baghdad from orchards in the east of Baquba, killing 8. In response, U.S. and Iraqi army forces fought the guerrillas for many hours on the street. And again, the Iraqi army that's been deployed to Baquba is the 5th Division, which is largely Shiite. Rocket-propelled grenades and light arms fire caromed through the city, leaving 18 persons dead and 19 wounded. It was unclear how many of the casualties were guerrillas. On Sunday, the curfew was lifted, but the main street was closed off. The guerrillas still had control over 4 districts in Baquba. They attacked another police checkpoint. The police said that in a separate incident, guerrillas loyal to Muqtada Sadr set fire to numerous shops in the market in revenge for attacks on their own offices in the city. Al-Zaman, correspondent in Baquba, this is a major Iraqi newspaper, wrote on Monday, November 20th, that the city, he said, is living through a parlous security situation. Police patrols disappear from the principal streets early in the day, and various armed groups thereafter have enormous sway. Reuters reported the same day that a senior police officer who declined to be named said, quote, "There is not a day that passes without dozens of people being killed, either from bombs, shootings, or assassinations. This has been going on for months." Now, I want to underline that no newspaper or wire service is reporting dozens of daily deaths in Baquba. That so many are being missed lends credence to the higher estimates for the deaths in the Lancet study. Many days no deaths at all are reported, sometimes only one or two make the news. But this senior police officer, an eyewitness, maintains that dozens are dying every day. And this story that I'm telling goes on through November into December, and reports are coming in from little towns around Baquba. It's not just the capital. On November 26th, it was reported that police found 21 bodies of Shiites in Balad Rose, a mainly Sunni city. On November 26th, AFP reported the guerrillas in the small town of Kan'an in Diyala, 12 miles south of Baquba, kidnapped at least 20 Iraqis of mixed tribe and sect. And usually the kidnapped don't show back up alive. On November 27th, it was reported that in the Arabic press that Sunni Arab guerrillas fought a pitched battle with police in the city of Bohriz near Baquba, defeated them, chased them out of their headquarters, and set it on fire and completely took over the city. So the guerrillas pushed the police out. Now, this story that I'm telling you could be told for other areas of Iraq, not just Diyala. The so-called Triangle of Death in Babil province, just south of Baghdad, which includes towns like Yusufiya, Mahmudiya, Iskandariya, Latifiya, sees similar kinds of daily grind of violence. A lot of the killing seems to be just people shooting people down. The press tends to favor reports of car bombings, but car bombings produce a relatively small percentage of the deaths. It's mostly just sniping and gunfire at one another. News gathering in contemporary Iraq is extremely dangerous and difficult. The collection and publication of social statistics has been affected by the violence and the anxieties that it spawns. Scientifically weighted household surveys are one instrument to supplement the desultory and staccato news reports about casualties in Iraq. It is clear that the level of sectarian violence and reprisals has increased substantially since February of 2006, when Sunni Arab guerrillas blew up the Askariya shrine in Samarra, among the holiest of the sites for the Shiites. The violence is now being pursued at the neighborhood and clan level, often at night or in dense urban tenements, such that the U.S. military appears unable to stop it. Indeed, the presence of so many U.S. troops in Iraq and the way in which they are often dragged willy-nilly into sectarian fights such as Diyala is probably impeding the natural process whereby Iraqis would be forced to compromise with one another.
Juan Cole, professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And that does it for our broadcast today. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Maté, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. Today at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, from 9 to 10, I'll be with Brian Lamb on Washington Journal on C-SPAN. Hope you tune in and call in. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.